There were two men. There's a rich man and a poor man. And these two men happened to be neighbors in a certain town. The rich man, he had a huge farm. It was full of sheep. It was full of cattle. The poor man didn't have a farm full of cattle or a farm full of sheep. In fact, he just had one little lamb. A lamb that he had raised from birth. And it was actually more like a household pet than the sheep or the cattle that belonged to the rich man. His children loved it only the way that children can love a household pet. And the oldest daughter would dress, well, you know, they named him Ralph. And the oldest daughter would dress Ralph up in her dress-up clothes, and you could just see the look on Ralph's face. You know, he wasn't really pleased with cross-dressing. But as pets do, they put up with it for the kids. You'd find the youngest son curled up with Ralph, and he'd be nuzzled all in Ralph's fluffy white coat and fast asleep, and one hand sucking on his thumb and another hand just with a kung fu grip on Ralph's coat there. The middle child couldn't pronounce his R's very well, and so he would call him Walf. Ralph had a seat at the family table. Even though the family was poor, they would let Ralph eat with them. The poor man would share his food with Ralph, and we're told that he would let Ralph drink from his own cup. After the children were in bed, the man's wife would catch the poor man fast asleep with Ralph in his arms, also fast asleep. Now, the rich man had a visitor from out of town come in, a traveler. And the rich man looked out at his huge number of sheep, and he didn't want to spare one of his sheep to feed his guest. He looked out at his huge number of cattle, and he didn't want to spare one of his cattle to feed his guest. So instead, the rich man walked over to the poor man's house, and he knocked on the door, and as the poor man's wife opened the door, answered the door, the rich man just kind of let himself in the rest of the way. Well, Ralph and the kids were in the middle of the living room playing a game of Monopoly. It's pretty intense. Ralph won average of 3 out of 4 games. They were always out to get him. The rich man walked over, snatched Ralph up by the nape of the neck, took him out on the front porch and slit Ralph's throat, and then took him back to his large farm to prepare a meal for his guest. The poor man did what he could to comfort his confused, crying children. As the rich man sat down to dinner with his out-of-town guest. That is a slightly, but not so very much, embellished story of the story that Nathan tells to David when Nathan confronts David after the sin of David and Bathsheba. When David is confronted by Nathan, he's busted for his lustful, adulterous, deceitful, and murderous behavior centered around the most famous story of adultery in all of history, the story of David and Bathsheba. You know, I would not like to be David. And I say that because David's story is recorded for generation after generation to read and reread the details of his sin. None of us would want that. None of us would like that. None of us would. How awful would that be? To have your most heinous sins to not only be recorded, but to be recorded in history's best-selling book that's not only read over a few millennia, but it is studied by a gazillion different people, picked apart. And that's where the detailed story of your heinous sins are recorded. I wouldn't want that at all. I don't think any of us would want that. And we have to start off today as we dive into this subject with that kind of understanding that we are reading about someone's dirtiest laundry, a level of exposure that none of us would like to have happen. None of us would want to be under the spotlight that David is under in this passage today, 2 Samuel 11 and 12. So let's keep that in mind, because it's easy to sit on the bleachers or in the comfort of your own home and watch and criticize quarterbacks like Palmer or Dalton. But how many of us can suit up and go out there and do any better at getting the ball to Ocho Cinco of years ago or today's AJ Green? So not only do we see the events of David's life in detail, but we see his thought process and we see his heart. The downright evil, rebellious thoughts, we see those. The amazingly honest, repentant thoughts, we see those. And so as we get started, we need to kind of set the bar here. So go on and turn to your neighbor and say, David was a sinner. And even on his good days, he still fell short of the glory of God. And now the mirror, I have sinned. And even on my good days, I still fall short of the glory of God. Romans 3:23, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. So back to the story of David and Bathsheba. We'll go back to the beginning there. In 2 Samuel chapter 11, we're told that it was in the spring. It was a time when the kings would go out to war. And David was sitting at home, comfy and safe. I don't know exactly why or what. Maybe he just kind of had his fill or thought he'd put in his time or whatever the case may be. But he wasn't where kings normally were at that time of the year. We're told that one evening David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. From the roof he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful. I don't care who you are. If you are a man and you see a naked woman bathing, you are going to be tempted to take a second glance. And the only exception to that is if your first glance turned into a stare. And you just don't have the opportunity for a second glance because you're still looking. You're going to be tempted to do that. Even if you're so well self-controlled that you're smart enough to look away after that first glance, there's still the thought in the back of your head, I'm alone on my own roof. It's late at night. Who's going to catch me taking a second glance? And then that second glance turns into a stare. Thousands of years later, things haven't changed much, have they? Sure, the dirty email came innocently to your inbox, or you happened to stumble on a nude scene on Skinamax after hours. That's what we called it in college. Try and keep us away from it, Skinamax. How long is that first stare? Is it a stare, or do you quickly minimize that window or quickly change the channel with your remote only to click back for a second glance because you think, I'm alone. Who's going to catch me? And that second glance turns into a stare. When subjects like this are brought up, I think all men kind of get the feeling that all the women are thinking, men are just pigs. Why can't they control themselves? You know, we are not pigs, not at our core. God wired us like this. And there are some positive things that come from that. And it is a struggle for men. That the first glance intrigues us because most men are visual, especially when it comes to sex appeal. Now, that's not an excuse. It is a realization of a truth that is true for most men. Jesus himself acknowledged this. He said in Matthew 5, he said, but I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully, he doesn't say that anyone who looks at another person lustfully. He specifically goes to the male gender looking at the female gender. Anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Jesus knows that's how we're wired. You know, I don't know what measures of discretion Bathsheba could have taken, or maybe she had taken it. I don't know how late at night it was. We're told that David went to bed and he woke up, got up from bed and was walking around on the roof. Maybe she was bathing late at night and maybe she was trying to use discretion that way. But you got to know who's within sight. You know, the temple's right there. The palace is right there in plain view. So I don't know. I don't know if she was using discretion or could have used more discretion or however that works. But the beginning of this story, it opens the door for a quick reminder for both sexes on this subject of sexuality. Men, you know that you are visual. So take evasive action when you're tempted to take the second glance or when you're tempted to stare. Take responsibility over how you're wired, and you know how you work. You know what tempts you. So choose not to take the second glance. Choose not to stare. Because you know it just gets worse from that point on. The struggle gets more difficult. It's more difficult to pull yourself away. And that just leads to one bad decision after another. Women, you know that if you dress a certain way or hold yourself in a certain manner, that you can easily gain the visual attention of men around you. Be responsible and use discretion. Sure, you have the freedom to wear skin-tight yoga pants and a low-cut scoop-neck shirt to do your grocery shopping. Because, I mean, who knows? You might need to break out and do a yoga workout in aisle number 5. It just might hit you, and you just got to do it. You never know. I mean, why else are you running around in that? But think of the kind of attention that you are inviting when you do that. Yeah, you have the freedom to do that, but think about what you're inviting. And dress yourself with that thought in mind when you go out publicly. Use discretion. Wives, feel free to wear the yoga pants around your husbands. So guys, you have to take a responsibility, and you cannot blame your lack of self-control on women who don't dress with discretion. You just can't do that. You got to take the higher road, guys. Amen? I normally don't ask for amens in this service, but we'll go old school on this because I need some feedback. Ladies, you have to take the responsibility and use discretion instead of saying, well, I can wear yoga pants and a low-cut shirt if I want. And if a man's got his mind in the gutter, well, then that's his problem. Take the higher road, ladies. Amen? All right, I got more to preach about than yoga pants and Skinamax. So David sees Bathsheba bathing, and he sends someone to find out about her. So this first glance turns into a stare, or maybe he was good enough to look away, and the second glance turns into a stare. But either way, the glance moves to a stare, and the stare moves to curiosity, and the curiosity starts moving towards actions. I'm curious about this woman. Who is she? And so he sends a man, and the man comes back. The man says that, isn't this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? Now, there are two big pieces of information here. First of all of us pick up on the one big piece of information. She's married. But it's deeper than that. It's more than that. She's not only married, but she's married to one of David's soldiers, who incidentally is out fighting in a war for David and his kingdom, while David's sitting at home enjoying his, you know, late night strolls and watching his wife bathe while he's out at war. A soldier that we find out is extremely loyal to Israel's army. And that loyalty to Israel's army is a reflection to his loyalty to David as king. Not only is she married, but she is the daughter of Eliam. And if this is the same Eliam we see in chapter 23 of 2 Samuel, then she is the daughter of one of David's mighty men. David had 37 of his most trusted military leaders that were called the mighty men. They were David's mighty men. There was 37 of them. Oh, and Uriah, Bathsheba's husband, he was also one of those 37 men, one of his mighty men. So this is the daughter of one of his more trusted colleagues, one of his, does that not have creeper written on it? He's looking at the daughter of his friend and wanting to know who she is. And the story, it just has runaway written all over it. She's the daughter of one of his mighty men. She's married to one of his mighty men. Of all the soldiers he's got, there's 37 of them that are the elite. And two of them are involved in this woman's life. But even after finding out this information, David sends for her. They sleep together and she becomes pregnant. So instead of owning up at this point, David decides to deceive. He decides to lie. He decides to try to pull off a cover-up plan when he should have used a cover-up plan a few verses ago, and that would have been the cover-up your eyes plan. But we're past that now. So he calls for Uriah, her husband. And David acts like he's wanting a report from the field. You know, come on in, tell me, how's it going? You know, how's Joab, the commander out there? Just give me a heads up on what's going on. And really, that's a lie. It's a farce. It's deception. The whole reason he wanted to bring Uriah home was so that Uriah would take the night, sleep with his wife, and then, oh, look, she's pregnant, and David's off the hook. Well, Uriah doesn't go home and sleep with his wife. Uriah slept at the entrance of the palace with the other servants. And when he was asked about this, Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah are all staying in tents, and my master Joab and my lord's men are camped in the open fields. How can I go to my house to eat and drink and lie with my wife? Surely as you live, I will not do such a thing." What kind of loyalty? It's just amazing. And you know that he's not, you know she's hot. So it's not like he's in, "I don't want to see my wife. I'd rather be at war." No. This is his level of loyalty and his dedication to his fellow men, to David. So David invites him to stay another night. He's going to try again. This time he's going to try and get him drunk. He fills him with alcohol, gets him drunk, and he sends Uriah home, hoping that he would sleep with his wife. But Uriah's resolve is more strong than even the alcohol. Uriah did not go home, and so David stoops even lower. We're told in the morning David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it with Uriah. That's just... In it he wrote, "Put Uriah in the front line where the fighting is fiercest, then withdraw from him so he will be struck down and die." So Joab puts Uriah in a place where the strongest defenders were, and Uriah, along with others, fall because he puts them in harm's way. And so now David acts like a hero, noble King David, and he's going to marry the poor widow of his mighty man, who died and fell fighting for the country. You know, David thinks he's all in the clear. She gives birth to a son. And he thinks that he's gotten away with it. His plan has worked. Until Nathan the prophet comes in and tells the story of Ralph the lamb. And David is furious when he hears the story of Ralph the lamb. He's furious about this man who would take his neighbor's only lamb and slaughter him to feed his guest. Instead of taking a lamb from his numerous concubines and wives, sheep. And David says this man should die. He should pay the price of Ralph the lamb four times over. And Nathan says to David, "You're that guy. You're the man. You're the rich man. You're the Ralph murderer." Nathan says to David, "You are the man. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I anointed you king over Israel." Listen to this list. "And I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave your master's house to you, and your master's wives into your arms. I gave you the house of Judah and of Israel. And if all this had been too little, I would have given you even more. Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? You struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword and took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites." So Nathan's story of the rich man and the poor man, it really gives us great perspective into looking at this story. Because just as easy as it was for David to sit back on the sidelines of that story and openly spout out condemnation on this rich man, it's just as easy for us to sit here on a Sunday morning and spout out condemnation on David or on other people who are caught or exposed in their heinous sin. We need to remember that we have all sinned. And even on our good days, we fall short of the glory of God. So let's take this story personally. Go on and pull your notes out. Some of the notes I don't have blanks in, but I'll have them up on the screen so you can follow along and know where we're headed. So from this spiel where God speaks to David through Nathan, we're reminded that God has provided David with all sorts of amazing things. So as we start to reflect on this, God has provided me with everything I need and so much more. Say so much more. God reminds David through Nathan that he has provided David in huge ways with enormous blessings. God says, I anointed you king over Israel. You're the second king that Israel's ever had. I did that for you. Saul wanted to kill you. I saved you. I rescued you once, twice, three, you know, over and over and over again. I did that for you, David. I put you in his palace. I gave you wives. I gave you rule and authority over the whole nation, over Israel and over Judah. And what gets me is this one verse in the midst of all this. And God even says, if all this had been too little, I would have given you even more. If all of this is too, I would have given you more. If this wasn't enough, that's a huge shopping list. And God's saying, if that were too little, I would have given you more. I'm big enough to give you more. I'm able. But David was the rich neighbor, and he took Ralph the lamb from the poor family next door. Why? Why? Because David looked at what God had given him, and he said, I want more. Let's write that down. One major starting point of sin is when I want more than God has chosen for me. That's where sin started, isn't it? Adam and Eve in the garden. You can eat from any of the trees that are here. Anything here. A vegan's paradise. Fruit and vegetables, and you can dig up roots and anything here. Except for this one tree. And that's where sin came from. Thanks, God, but I want more than what you've chosen for me. I want that thing that you have not given to me. I want more. Think of this story with David and all of the sins that found their root in that attitude of, I want more. Lust, that second glance, the stare, adultery, acting on it, greed, deception and lies trying to cover it up, entitlement, I deserve this, I'm king. This even leads to murder in this story. Think of some of the other sins that we have in our world that we struggle with that find their root in this attitude of, you know, of all the things God's given me, I want more. I want something more. Other sexual immoralities, pride, selfish ambition, jealousy, envy, bitterness, complaining, ungratefulness, extortion, taking advantage of other people, stealing, idolatry. Even witchcraft has its roots here, where someone's saying, I want more than what God has given me, and I want to take another road to get there. I'm going to go outside of his plan because that's the only way you're going to get more than what God has chosen to give you. 1 Timothy chapter 6, it says, but godliness with contentment is great gain, for we brought nothing into the world and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we'll be content with that. People who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. It's the same pattern we saw with David and lust that we see with money that's described here by Paul to Timothy. People that they fall in love, they want to get rich, they fall into this temptation, into the trap. The glance turns into a stare that turns into action, turns into greed, and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. That's where it ends. And you see this in that. You see it in money. People don't feel like God has provided enough for them, so they seek other ways to get more money. And it doesn't have to be as outlandish as holding up the speedway. It comes from other forms like lying, cheating on your taxes because you feel like you deserve more. You need more than what God has chosen to give you. Taking advantage of someone else financially, lying to a customer to get the sale from another company, or lying to your boss to get that, to get the extra edge, to get the promotion, to get more money. We see this in sexual encounters of various forms. One represented here, that the married person seeking extramarital affairs or adultery because they aren't content with what God has given them, wanting more than what God has chosen to give. We see this in the sexual sins of the single person, going outside of God's ways to get more for themselves than what God has chosen to give them at that point in time in their life. We see this just pride in general. People who are not content with what God has provided them with because they think they're entitled to something more. I deserve something more. People who are ungrateful for what God has provided. People, some who think of themselves more highly than they ought. Others who are jealous of what the other guy has because they believe it should belong to them because they want more than what God has provided for them. See, getting something more than what God has intended for me means going outside of his plan for me. Let's write that down. Because if you're in God's plan, then you have exactly what God has planned for you to have, what he has chosen for you to have. The only way to get more is to go outside of his plan. The only way to go outside of God's plan is to reject God's ways. We're starting to get in really dangerous territory here. It's what David did. It's what Adam and Eve did. It's what we do. I want more. I'm going to take more. The only way to do that is to go outside of God's way, and that is rejecting his ways. To go outside of his plan and reject his ways. That's how it happens. Give me a moment. People are writing feverishly those three words. I tried to make them short ones. So we go outside of God's plan. We reject God's ways. This rebellion is called sin. Sin will take me farther than I want to go and cost me more than I can afford. Sin will take me farther than I want to go and cost me more than I can afford. Samuel 12, as Nathan confronts David, kind of overlap a little bit some of what we've already read. Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? You struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword and took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now, therefore, the sword will never depart from your house because you despised me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own. There are going to be earthly consequences after this. This is what the Lord says. Out of your own household, I'm going to bring calamity upon you. Before your very eyes, I will take your wives and give them to one who is close to you. And he will lie with your wives in broad daylight. You did it in secret, but I will do this thing in broad daylight before all Israel. Then David said to Nathan, and I want to pause because there's so many different ways we react in these situations and times, especially when you're in fifth gear and you're cruising. You know, you start off and there's the glance and the second glance and the stare and the curiosity and then the acting on it and then the covering up and then the killing and then taking her as, oh, I'm so noble. I'm taking this poor widow into my house and she can be my wife and I'll take care of her now that her husband's dead. All this, when you get to this point, you're cruising. You've got a lot of velocity. You've got a lot of momentum going. And so at that point, it would be so easy to just spout right back out at Nathan. You are a liar. You're full of, you know, come in, guards, get him, kill him. Bottom dungeon, whatever it takes, get this guy out of my presence. There's so many different ways he could go. But David has a moment there of that realization, and he humbles himself, and he simply admits. He simply comes clean at that point. And he says, I've sinned against the Lord. You know, when we get to that point, we've got so much velocity, so much momentum, so much that we've invested into hiding a sin, so much we've invested into keeping the sin alive in our life. And we have some of those moments, those breaking moments where there's an opportunity where God's saying, here's your way out. I'm giving it to you. It's not comfortable, but God sent Nathan to David to give him that breaking moment. Here's your chance to stop this now. And things are not going to be great. It's not going to be like it was before. You've kind of ruined that. But we can still have something. How many times in our lives when we get to that moment and we just keep going down the same road? We need to look at David here and take a step back and say, you know what? This is a big deal. He admits, I've sinned against the Lord. Nathan replied, the Lord has taken away your sin. Boom. And that's pre-Jesus. That's just awesome. You're not going to die. But because by doing this, you have made the enemies of the Lord show utter contempt, the son born to you will die. So let's write some things down here under the heading that God provides forgiveness and restoration after we sin. We need to hear that. We need to hear that on a regular basis because we have all sinned. And we, even on our best days, we do not live up to the glory of God. So we need to hear that God provides forgiveness and restoration after we sin. So we follow David's example here in a couple different things that show up. Take responsibility. So we're going to take this personally. Take responsibility of my sin and admit my guilt honestly to God. There's got to be a time when you stop and you just come clean because it's not going to end if you don't. It's just not. And it's just got to be a cold turkey deal. It's just got to be a, God, I'm laying it down now. You can't hold on to a string. You can't hold on to just one little piece. It's got to be a lay down. It's got to be a, here it is. I really screwed up. You know, after Nathan confronts David, I've sinned against the Lord. He doesn't avoid the responsibility. He finally takes responsibility. Someone here needs to take responsibility. And you need to talk to God honestly today. And it might be more than one person. And you need to share with him that today's the day that you're going to break the chain. Today is the day. I like how many of you guys read your chapter in the story this week? You got to keep up with that because this week's chapter was awesome the way they did it. This week's chapter, what they did was they interspersed, like I think it was three different psalms that David wrote into the story, which I thought was awesome. You don't get that when you're reading the Bible that's separated out in, you know, 2 Samuel and then Psalms. And these were psalms that David wrote while he was going through this. So we get a chance to see his emotional, the way he works through this, the way he struggles through this. And one of the psalms that's quoted is Psalm 51. And it is directly connected to David's response to God when Nathan confronts him about his sin with Bathsheba. And David humbly admits his guilt before God and he seeks God's grace. He seeks his forgiveness. David finds hope in God's ability to restore things that are broken and repair things that need to be fixed. But even though David is repentant, his son still dies. See, sometimes there will be earthly consequences to our sin, even after we repent, even after we admit our guilt to God. So we should accept those with dignity. I think David did the best he could do in the midst of the rest of his life, the calamity that was coming upon him. So let's write that down. Accept the earthly consequences of my sin and live with or through them with dignity. David's son is sick for many days, and during this time, David pleads with God, hoping that God would change his mind, hoping that God would change the direction. But after news came about his son's death, David got up and he washed. He changed his clothes, and I think this is amazing, and this is something to just really highlight in this story. He does something very strange and something that you don't see many people react like this. He worships God before he goes and fills his stomach. He washes, changes clothes, and he goes and worships God. How many of us, you know, in those situations, it's so easy to be angry. You know, this happened and this happened and this happened. And you know full well, they're the results of your choices, your bad choices. But man, so many times we just blame God. You let me do this. You put her out there. You woke me up at night and had me out on the rooftop walking around. You did this. You did. Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you send this? Why didn't you do that? And we're angry and we don't respond in this way. And I think it's an amazing thing to highlight this and bring this up out of David's life, that he worships God. He worships God. And then he eats a meal and then he goes and he comforts Bathsheba. When he was asked about this, he says that when the child was still alive, that he was pleading that God would have mercy on the child. But once the earthly consequence had come to pass, it was time to pick up. It was time to dust yourself off. What's done is done. It's over. And let's continue on. He worships God. And then he eats and he comforts Bathsheba. The bad choices are in the past. See, in front of him stood a woman. Regardless of how they came to meet, she was a person. And you got to imagine what she was going through. Guilt, shame, embarrassment. Her husband's dead. Her child is dead. Mothers would understand this far greater than any guy in this room would. She carried the baby. We have nothing to believe that it wasn't full term. She gives birth. And the baby's sick and dies. And what does David do? Okay, we made some bad decisions, but now it's time to make some good ones. And he comforts her. I think there's a lot to learn here. Accept the earthly consequences with dignity. What's done is done. Don't make a second round of bad choices or a third round of bad choices because you're still upset about the first round of bad choices. Do you get me? Because I think that's where Satan wins his biggest battles. He'll strike you down up here and he'll get you down. But it's down here where he wins the big one. It's that second and third round of bad choices. It's when you don't get up. It's when you don't continue on. It's when you don't say, okay, we gotta keep going. There's going to be junk in my life now. There's going to be some baggage attached to this. I can't let it stop any of the other decisions from here on out. I got to start making some better decisions here. So we need to accept the earthly consequences and live through them with dignity. And then experience the forgiving grace of God and allow God to restore me to the place he has called me to serve. You can't stay here. When it's happened and you repent and you seek forgiveness and you accept the consequences, the earthly consequences, then you got to climb back up and get where God wants you. You have to allow him to put you there. Allow him to restore you. See, after this, David goes out to his army. After this whole situation, the pleading and crying and then the death and then the washing and the dressing and then the worshiping, eating, comforting his wife, then he goes out and he is restored to his place where he should have been in the first place. He goes out and joins his men in battle. He goes and he's the king of Israel again. Some of you need to hear that today. You've had a sin that you've either been struggling with or a sin that you have struggled with. You might have been forgiven for that sin for years, but you still haven't allowed God to restore you to a place of service, the place where he has called you to be in his kingdom. Don't let Satan win the other battles. Don't let him win the bigger ones. Allow God to restore you. Allow God to put you back in the place where he wants you to be. So now we have a little box, a container of bullet point number 2 in our outline. God provides forgiveness. He provides grace. We need to hear that. But with that understood, fully understood, packaged up, let's set that aside for a moment because we need to be reminded that's not a cop-out for making bad decisions. Plan A is always choosing the holy choice. Let's write this down. Though God is able and willing to forgive and restore, the holy choice is always the best choice from the beginning. Always the best choice from the beginning. The long-term consequences of giving into a sin always outweigh the discomfort of rejecting a sin. Every one of us, honest to ourselves, rejecting sin is not easy. It is uncomfortable. But I guarantee you that the discomfort of rejecting a sin is far more gentle than the suffering of the long-term consequences of giving into it. In David's life, we have no way to get into the things that happen in the chapters to come. And if you read your story, then you know some of the things that happened. The calamity that God speaks of. The baby dies, we know about that. David's household turns into a mess. His daughter is raped by a brother. David's own son Absalom rebels from David. This has kingdom consequences over the kingdom of Israel. It causes problems all across the nation. David flees into exile while Absalom rebels, and Absalom takes on the throne, and he gets the palace and all the wives, and all that happens like God said it would. Absalom dies, and then David's other son provokes another major revolt, rebellion. See, God provided a holy choice that would have been far better than the rebellious choice that David chose. Far better. The long-term consequences certainly outweighed the temporary discomfort of rejecting the sin. So last week, so let's back up a little bit. And I'm going to invite the band to come on up. Last week, we talked about David and one of his high points. I mean, David and Goliath. One of the stories you think of when you think of the Bible, you think of David and Goliath. And in the victory there, not of David and Goliath, in a separate victory, we see David dancing in the streets, half naked, worshiping God. Today we see David at one of his lowest points, if not the lowest point. And what does he do down here? He worships God. He worships God. And as we back up and we just look at the life of David, there is one consistent thread that goes through his life. And that is he had a relationship with God through the good, the bad, the ugly, the ups, the downs, no matter what he was, the choices he was making, he maintained that relationship. And you can see that in the Psalms as you read these honest feelings that David had, the anger he had, the remorse he had, the joy he had. He was just amazing amounts of emotions that were connected to this relationship with God. No matter what his life was, David constantly worshiped God, and I think every one of us need to be reminded of that, and that's why I ask these guys to wait on the singing portion until after. Because some of you, you're in a place, you're at a high place right now. You know, things are going great. You're at a high light in your spiritual walk. It's a mountaintop experience. And I want you to be reminded and see David's life and to be reminded, you can't take credit for this. You can't say, I'm on this mountaintop because it's all me and I'm all great and everything. You need to give God the glory. You need to give God credit. You need to worship God from the mountain. Some of you are going to be in the between. You're going to be in the middle here today. And it's not great right now, and it's not really that bad. It's just, You need to be reminded, worship God in those times. Some of you are in this category this morning. And maybe this category has kept you separate from worshiping God for a while. You need to lay it down today and just worship him. No matter what your choices are, no matter what you look like, God has seen the dirtiest of the dirty and he still welcomes their worship. So this morning, I ask you guys to stand in the band to start playing some songs. And during this first song, if you feel the need to come forward, you can stand. If you feel the need to come forward as an invitation song, if you want to accept Jesus as your Lord and Savior, if you want to pray alone, you can pray at the stage. If you want someone to pray with you, you can pray at the front pew. If you want to join our church, you can come forward. And I'll stand here for this first song, but as they continue through three more songs, I'm just going to step aside and we're all just going to worship. If we can bring the lights down. And let's just lift God up and worship him.